Okay, the next matter on calendar is Redmond versus State, case number 58547. Nancy Lemke is appearing for the appellant and Ryan McDonald for the respondent. Ms. Lemke, are you prepared to proceed?
I believe so, Your Honor, if I may approach here.
Again, just for the record, my name is Nancy Lemke. I'm an attorney with the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I will be representing Mr. Redmond this morning in this matter. If I might, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. And before we start going, may I just inquire of the clerk whether or not you will give me the warning sign at 10 minutes, or do I need to kind of keep track of the time?
When you have 4 minutes remaining, you will go to the light yellow on the screen.
Okay, when I have the 4 minutes remaining. Okay, so I know that that's when the 4 minutes is. Okay. My apologies for doing that, but I just want to make sure because I've had some problems with that.
Ms. Lemke, before you get started, I just have one kind of background issue that I was a little confused on. My understanding in this case, the defense moved for a bench trial on this. So you had a bench trial, but then we had, quote, jury instructions, instructions on law and various issues. Generally, when you have a bench trial, and I know you've done this for a few years and all like that, do you instruct the judge on the law similar to instructing the jury with jury instructions, or is the judge just consider the law based upon what the law is and apply the appropriate beyond a reasonable doubt standards and all and other insanity issues? How does that work?
Well, to be honest with you, I myself have never done a bench trial. The prudent approach certainly would be to have the judge actually give instructions to him or herself, so that there's, we all know what the judge is operating under in terms of, you know, legal guidelines, because that's going to make a difference in terms of what ultimately is argued to the court in summation, and it's going to make a difference certainly in what evidence is presented. And as we get going talking about the case here, there were some requests that were made ahead of time for the judge to consider the law in certain respects, and they wanted the evidence tailored to that. So without question, the more prudent approach is to actually have a set of instructions rendered, and if nothing else, that then gives this court the ability to see whether or not the judge was in fact applying the correct law. Because as it comes, when it comes down to it in this particular case, really that's why we're here, is to talk about the legal issues. There were certainly some factual disputes, but really the assignments of error that have been raised in this case revolve largely around the manner in which the trial court instructed itself. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? Okay, so, and as I kind of just alluded to in my response to Justice Gibbons' question, the reason that we're really here today is because the legal standards under which William Redmond was tried effectively precluded his ability to prevail on his not guilty by reason of insanity defense. First and foremost, before this court, is the jury instruction that the court gave itself regarding the definition of insanity in Nevada. That would be, I'm referring to instruction number 16. And let me say, just kind of preliminarily where this is concerned, the state very cleverly, in their responding briefing materials, frame this as, well, we're asking for the legal standard of our choice to be employed here because we want the standard that's most favorable to whatever factual defense we have in terms of the insanity claim that our defendant is proffering. And that's not at all what's happening. We are, in fact, asking for enforcement of 174.035. Period. We're not asking for anything other than a plain application of that particular statute. Because what happens here is the trial court actually gave 174.035, but the trial court gave a little bit more. And that was that little blurb from Finger, that being the case that reinstated our insanity defense here in Nevada. And it gives an example of what amounts to legal insanity. Now let's go back for just a second and talk about kind of the evolution of how our 174.035 came to be. You know, what happened was there was an abolition of the insanity defense in Nevada. This honorable court said, no, there is a due process right to be able to proffer an insanity defense. And in response to that, the Nevada legislature codifies, they enact 174.035, which gives rise to what we have now is our insanity defense in Nevada. And what that says is that, in a nutshell here, due to a mental disease or defect, The defendant was deluded and either did not know or understand the nature and capacity of his act or appreciate the conduct was wrong, meaning not authorized by law. What Instruction 16 did was it actually added a specific example from the Finger case, which again was the case that said, look, we have to have an insanity defense in Nevada. And what that example said was this. If the defendant was suffering from a delusional state and the facts as he believed them while in that delusional state would have justified his action, he's insane. Basically it said, look, your delusion has to, if true, amount to a legal defense. That was an example that this court gave in Finger of what would amount to a legal defense. But it wasn't exhaustive. It was just one example. So what happens is now when the legislature enacts 174.035, they don't put that example in 174.035. They just say, look, if you have a disease or defect of the mind, and because of that, you do not understand the nature and capacity of your action, or you can't distinguish right from wrong, you're entitled to prosecute an insanity claim in the state of Nevada. The legislature actually, a few years later, considered whether or not they should take that limiting example from Finger and actually codify that in the statute. If you look at the 2007 legislative history, where there were some amendments made to 174.035, the DA's office actually proposed to codify this very limiting example from Finger. And the legislature expressly rejected it. They did not adopt that particular language. Now what happens is you fast forward to Mr. Redmond's case, and now we see this language reappearing, this very limiting language. You see it reappearing again in his jury instruction. And what this did was it basically told the fact finder, in this case the judge, look, if his delusion does not amount to a legal defense, if it were true, then he is precluded from asserting insanity verdict.
I love your argument. If this was a jury trial, this was a bench trial. Now, how do you say that there's error in a jury instruction when it's a bench trial? I did one bench trial when I was a public defender, and I never did it again. And when I saw that this was a bench trial, after I got off the floor, I said to myself, how are they going to raise this issue? Now, I think what you want us to do is to say that Finger really doesn't demand that it be a justifiable delusion, but any delusion. If God says to kill a child, that's a delusion that could be an insanity defense. Or if the person says, I killed the child because I thought they were a terrorist and an enemy of the state, that's a justifiable thing, or if it was in self-defense. So, Ms. Lumpke, how do we get to your issue when it's a bench trial?
Right, Your Honor actually raises a good point. But she was a fact finder just like everybody, like a jury would be. And to the extent that that instruction told her, look, you, Your Honor, cannot make a finding of insanity if he doesn't have a delusion that amounts to a legal defense.
But do we know that she followed that instruction? Did she make a finding that, yes, the delusion was one that is not justifiable under Finger 174.05?
Well, I'm going to tell you how we know that she had to have, because here's what the testimony was. You know, you had the testimony from the defense experts who said, look, he fits within the definition of 174.035.
Two of them said he was insane.
Correct. Under 174.035, there was actually some defense concessions that he doesn't fit that little narrow example from Finger that was contained in jury instruction number 16. Here's what's interesting. If you look at the state's expert testimony, the state's own expert actually gives us our NGRI defense. Because what she testifies to, and this was really interesting, I was shocked, quite frankly, when I read it. I wasn't trial counsel. But this is what Dr. Piasecki says, and she was the state's expert. She says that the defendant's actions were caused primarily by intoxication. Now, we've got a separate issue I'm going to get to in a minute. But subsection 9A of 174.035 says that that you have an insanity claim as long as the crime was not caused solely by voluntary intoxication. So what that means is that as long as it's caused by some mental defect, even if there's some mixture of voluntary intoxication in there, you still can proffer that insanity that insanity argument. So now this is critical, because what Piasecki ends up saying is, she ends up saying, look, it was caused primarily by intoxication. She would not say it was caused solely. So she's basically conceding, Piasecki is, that the defect played a part in causing what Mr. Redmond did on the day in question. Secondly, and most importantly, she says, and I'm quoting here, I think if it was just the first part of 174.035, that is not being able to understand the nature and capacity of your act, I think if it's just the first part that he could not appreciate his conduct was wrong, I think if the Nevada statutory definition ended there, that Mr. Redmond would be fitting that definition. Well, I have news for Dr. Piasecki. It did end there, because the statute is alternative, not conjunctive. It says, if you don't understand the nature and capacity of your action, or if you can't distinguish right from wrong, either one of those two things, as long as you have the defect that part and parcel causes your conduct, you are insane in the state of Nevada. You have the state's own expert, by virtue of her direct testimony, essentially conceding that he met 174.035. So what I say to your honor is this. When you consider the defense testimony that obviously said under 174.035 he's insane, and you add into that the state's the one and only expert they called who actually ultimately admits that he fits 174.035. She may not have knowingly, realized that she was making that concession, but indeed she did. That was the only evidence that was presented at trial, was that he met 174.035. So you have to ask yourself, if the undisputed evidence was such that he met 174.035, why was there a finding that he was guilty but mentally ill? Because that critically limiting language from jury instruction 16, which was the example culled from Finger, improperly limited 174.035 in a way that precluded Mr. Redmond from ever prevailing on his defense. As typical of me, I've talked too much and I'm already at my 4 minutes that I need to save for rebuttal. So if I may, I will allow the state to argue and then I can conclude my rebuttal.
For the record, Ryan McDonald, Deputy DA, Clark County. I'd like to say to start that Mr. Redmond could not prevail in this case under the not guilty by reason of insanity plea because he's not insane under the McNaughton test. The statute in question codified
the experts that said that he did not have a guilty right, wrong, or he could not qualify under appreciation of the act that he committed. Why do you say that?
I think in this case,
certainly they met the preponderance of the evidence to get it to where you had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was saved. With two witnesses.
The burden of proof is on him to prove by a preponderance that he meets the legal definition of insanity.
And didn't two psychiatrists say that, or two expert witnesses say that?
A few of the experts were confused, I think, about the McNaughton test. One of the defense experts, Dr. Bittaker, who oftentimes the state retains, continued to read out the part of Finger that I also want to emphasize, that the conduct at issue, his delusional state, the conduct at issue must not be authorized by law. So he,
but is that part of the statute actually?
That is part of the statute.
Stumpke seems to say that it really isn't.
And she reads that part out as well. So subsection 2 of the statute at issue says, have been in a delusional state such that he did not appreciate that his conduct was wrong, meaning not authorized by law. So the last part that she takes issue with, this excerpt from the Finger opinion, is simply a restatement of subsection 2. You know, in the Finger opinion, it gives several examples of, what is the kind of cognitive incapacity that is detailed in Section 1. That's the, you know, he had a knife, but he thought he was slicing off a pat of butter instead of slicing into his daughter's neck. And so under subsection 2, that he did not know was not authorized by law, he thought that he was a surgeon and he was performing surgery on his daughter, so he thought it was authorized by law.
Was he mentally ill?
Excuse me?
Did the judge find he was mentally ill?
He's guilty but mentally ill.
Okay, then why is it the second degree instead of first degree? Under either Fox, which I think is still law in the state, where mental illness intentions say that you can't premeditate and there's no first degree murder, and also the voluntary intoxication reduces first degree to second degree.
Both of those things do go to the specific intent for first degree murder, but apparently in this case, Judge Kadish found that this defendant did not meet that requirement. There was, you know, to state that there was only the expert testimony here, of course there was the entire state's case in chief, okay? And so you have all of the defendant's statements saying, you know, he called 911 after he killed his daughter and, you know, he said, oops, my knife slipped. You know, he knew to call 911. These are all indicia of the fact that he knew that his conduct was not authorized by law, that he had some kind of consciousness of guilt.
Was there any explanation for why he put the knife in her hand and inflicted all those wounds on himself?
There was not really any explanation, although he did tell the EMTs afterwards that, you know, just let me die, let me go too, which is also some indication that he knew that what he did was wrong.
Okay. Mr. McDonald, if I could, Ms. Lemke didn't address this yet in her argument, but in the opening brief from the defense, they make a big point of the Ney case and the felony murder rule and whether you can have murder by child abuse under Ney if that's permissible. Could you address that? And wouldn't murder by child abuse be a general intent, first-degree murder, where you wouldn't have to prove specific intent then?
That's correct. And that we did argue that in our brief that, you know, because you have the felony murder component, you have a kind of workaround for the specific intent under first-degree murder.
Now, does Ney, and I think that was Justice Cherry's case where it was the rob, where the guy Ney killed somebody, and then I guess
afterwards. He robbed them afterwards.
Afterwards, you stole some property from him. Is that applicable to this case?
I don't think there's any evidence in this case that he killed his daughter and then inflicted abuse. I think the abuse would have necessarily preceded the mortal wounding.
Okay. So, and I'm reading the...
Wait, are you saying that every child abuse is... every murder of a child would be child abuse?
Every murder that occurs in the context of child abuse under the definition of in the child abuse statute would be felony murder. Just like every murder that occurs in the course of a robbery...
No merger or anything between the child abuse and the actual killing of a child. You see what I'm saying? In other words, any time you kill a child, you're saying it's felony murder and it's first-degree murder. If you kill a child, I don't think that's our case law here. I've seen some of our cases where it's been second-degree murder.
I see where you're going.
Yeah.
And I think you can have a felony murder type situation under child abuse that is not, you know, kind of a strict liability murder in the case of children, which is what the appellant proffered. For example, you know, if the child is on a subway platform, you know, and push in front of the train, I would say under that situation, that's not a child abuse situation. You know, there's no agency or guardianship kind of relationship.
Mr. McDonald, again, the judgment of conviction that Judge Kaylee Shannard indicates she adjudicated him guilty of first-degree murder, but I don't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, she indicated whether it was based on premeditation or based upon murder by child abuse.
There was no special verdict form on that issue.
Thank you.
Was there an indication, there's, at least I picked up something as I went through this, that there was a knowing aspect to what he had done? And there was some indication to one of the experts when they were discussing the murder, and he was asked if what he had done was murder, and he responded, yeah, I know this. Tell me how that plays into.
I think the evidence is quite clear that he does not meet the first subsection, the cognitive, that he knew the nature and quality of his acts. You do have some experts who don't seem to understand the McNaughton rule as thoroughly as perhaps Judge Kadish did. But under that first subsection, you had to have not known that you were murdering your daughter. And the evidence was quite clear. He said to almost everyone that he met after he committed the crime that he killed her. He also said that, you know, maybe if, you know, my wife can bring her back in 3 days or whatever. But I think it was quite clear that he, and his own statements to 911, he said, I did it, I killed her. And he said that to the EMT, he said that to the police, he said, I did it, I killed her. So the argument really is under the second prong, whether under the state of his delusion, accepting that he had some kind of delusion, whether that murder was authorized by law.
But if he said that I killed him in self-defense because he was going to poison me, then you'd be singing a different tune. Under the statute and under finger.
If he said that I murdered her because of self-defense, actually we did do a self-defense instruction in this case because there was that testimony that she had a knife in her hand. So it wasn't clear whether the defense was going to argue that there was self-defense. And it turned out they're simply arguing that he was insane. And so under the facts of this case, even accepting his delusion that he thought he would kill her, and then his wife would be able to resurrect her in 3 days, or that God or an alien told him to do it, that does not meet the second component of the McNaughton test that's reflected in the statute and that's reflected in Finger. And in fact, there's language in the Finger opinion that says, for example, if a person was under a delusion that God wanted certain people killed, and based upon hearing the voice of God, that individual immediately began killing people around them, that person would be legally insane under the irresistible impulse test, but not under the McNaughton standard.
What was the impact of the evidence that the guy was a heavy marijuana user, and I can't remember what other illegal drugs he used?
Yes, the state's expert, in her final conclusion, said that this, to the extent that he was under any kind of delusion or psychotic state, that it was due to his intoxication from methamphetamine and marijuana. He told several people, in the treating EMTs, when they asked, you know, does he have any history of mental illness? Do you know where you are? Do you know what you're doing? Are you under any medication? He answered all of those questions quite fluently and said, I smoke a lot of pot. So the evidence that he was smoking marijuana on that day is pretty clear. The evidence as to his methamphetamine intoxication is somewhat less clear. There's evidence that he was a regular user in the early 90s. There was also some conflicting evidence that he had been a continuous user over the next 18 years. And so the state's expert, as part of her opinion, relied on that when she said that his psychotic state is due to this intoxication because of the effects of long-term methamphetamine use. So the order narrowing the issues directed me to address two others. There was some issue about the messages in the cell phone. Apparently, Gloria's had a cell phone, and there was some kind of hearsay evidence that there was some message on there about, you know, oh, my dad's talking to himself again or something like that. I just wanted to direct the court's attention to to the testimony of Mr. Redmond's son, William James, who testified to his father's strange and erratic behavior over a period of time, just to address the materiality component that the court directed our attention to, whether it's material or whether it's rather simply cumulative to all of the other evidence that, yes, Mr. Redmond had a tendency to talk to himself, especially when he was home alone, but that when he was out and about, when he was working interacting with society, that he acted quite normally. The other issue is the intoxication instruction. There's some argument about equal protection, and I just wanted to note that this court in Finger found that the McNaughton test meets the fundamental right test under due process. So the court said there's a fundamental right to an insanity defense, and that the existing statutory structure at the time that had the mens rea defense that abrogated the affirmative insanity defense did not meet the due process requirements of the federal and state constitutions, but that the McNaughton test impliedly would. So the McNaughton test meets the fundamental right standard of due process, and therefore it must meet the fundamental right test under the Equal Protection Clause. There's no separate analysis for fundamental rights recognized under equal protection and fundamental rights under substantive due process. So if the McNaughton test meets due process, it also meets equal protection. As to the intoxication instruction, there can't be an equal protection violation because, giving a voluntary intoxication instruction is rationally related to the state's recognized interest in defining the parameters of criminal responsibility, and also to avoid situations like the one that was mentioned in our brief about the individual who was voluntarily intoxicated and was able, through the insanity affirmative defense, to avoid complete liability for his crime instead of using it to attack the specific intent component. And so the voluntary instruction addendum was added for that purpose.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
Mr. McDonald, Ms. Lankey commented on the giving, quote, jury instructions on criminal bench trials. What's your thought on that procedure? Should it be used or not? Is it authorized by law?
When I first saw that, I also kind of had to look that up.
What did you find?
I think it is a good procedure in that it kind of leaves a paper trail for appellate purposes. You have the exact law that the judge relied on, and you also have the process of settling jury instructions where both parties have their input on what the law in this case should be and how the judge should instruct herself.
Don't you think that we should follow the federal court rule about trial memos rather than jury instructions, calling them jury instructions, having trial memos?
I have no personal opinion on that. But some kind of memorialization of it, I think, is what I find, to be a good idea in the process. So, whatever the method would be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's where I feel the compulsion to invoke the Lemke rule, because I feel like I've got so much to say and so little time within which to say it. Let me just clear up something in the record. The testimony was undisputed that Mr. Redmond did not understand the nature and capacity of his act, contrary to what counsel for the state just articulated to this court. Yes, he indicated that he killed his
There were some statements to the effect that he killed his daughter, but he also harbored the belief that she was going to resurrect in 3 days. So it wasn't a killing in the sense that you and I think of one where there's a permanence to it. It was his delusional belief network that led him to think that she was going to come back and be fine and in the process save the world and himself.
But the only way we can reverse this, the only way is we find something wrong with 174035, our finger. We'd have to modify or overrule or whatever to do the finger. Because this is a bench trial. In other words, was there substantial evidence that this guy killed his daughter? Absolutely. I mean, how would you write an opinion on this case saying what you're saying about the evidence about intoxication? No, so what? It was a bench trial. Kadish made the rules. Judge Kadish made the findings.
Very simply, Your Honor, she needs to follow 174035, and she didn't. And this is really critical in this particular case because the example that was given from Finger, and it was an example, and despite what counsel for the state is now telling this court, that no, it wasn't just an example, it was actually part of the instruction, that's not true. If you look at the legislative history on this, you see the testimony from Chris Lally where he tells the legislature, you know what, this little blurb from Finger that talks about, well, you know, if true, you know, it would amount to a legal defense, that is really just an example. If you'd like the quote, I can give it to Your Honors. It was an example. It wasn't meant to be exhaustive. So the problem is that unfairly limits what's codified at 174035. If you go with just 174035, which is what the trial court should have done, and left out that little example from Finger that was very limiting and did not reflect the purpose of 174035, if you went with just 174035, he meets the criteria for legal insanity. That's why the addition of that language that the state requested very cleverly, because they knew he wouldn't need it. Our own expert said, I don't know that if true, this would amount to a legal defense.
What objection was there to that instruction when it was proffered?
Well, first of all, there was a pretrial motion made. Actually, I think the motion was made right after
the trial. Strike that portion of the instruction?
Two things, Your Honor. That's a good question. One, they actually, as trial started, they said, we don't want any evidence to come in regarding whether or not the delusion amounted to a legal offense, because that is not 174.35. That's the example from Finger. It's limiting. It's not the statute. Then again, if you look at the testimony, every time it comes up when there's an expert witness on the stand, every single time that there's a question asked about, well, does this amount to a legal defense? And now you've got psychiatric experts trying to opine about legal matters. Number one, that's beyond the scope of their expertise. Number two, they can't do it. As Your Honors know, there's abundance of case law that says you can't offer opinions on legal conclusions. Now you've got experts wading into this quagmire about what amounts to a legal defense, maybe in the state of Nevada. It was almost comical. But I'll tell you what, you see an objection from the defense every time it happens, and then again, when they go to settle instructions, they object to this language again in the instruction, because they know, as the state knows, that if they get this blurb in there, our client cannot prevail on his insanity defense, because by and large, the testimony was such that this didn't necessarily amount to perfect self-defense in Nevada.
It's a bench trial. That's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't matter what... Let's say that you're right. Why is it a harmless error, then, under all the facts of this case?
Because, again, all the experts, including the state's own experts, the state's own expert, again, I think she unknowingly did this, but she ultimately said that he qualifies under 174035 because she says he meets the first prong of 5A. She says, look, I don't think he knew, understood the nature and capacity of his act, and I don't think that his disease or that his actions were caused solely by the intoxication. If you look at 174035, that's it, game, set, and match. But she labored under the misapprehension that you had to have both. You had to have not understand nature and capacity of the act and not understand that the act was wrong, and that's not true. It's an alternative statute, not a conjunctive statute. If you have one of those two, which she conceded he had, she wins. So I don't think she really realized what she was doing when she made those concessions, but if you look at the record, those are the concessions she made. So what does that leave you with? It leaves you with undisputed evidence that he made a showing under 174035, which means that the only reason that Judge Kadish couldn't have given returned a not guilty by reason of insanity verdict is because of that limiting language that was included in that instruction 16. And the other problem with that is that ultimately, if you were going to say that that language is appropriate, it was only appropriate to subsection 2, which is the wrongfulness of the conduct, meaning not authorized by law, which is what respondent just alluded to. But if you look at the instruction, it doesn't specify that that little blurb is limited to that second section. The instruction number 16 reads as though the deletion has to be a legal defense applies to the entire statute 174.035. And counsel for the state just conceded that it only applies, if it applies at all, it applies only to the second, knowing the wrongfulness of the conduct part. So you look at that instruction, and that was the reason that she couldn't find him not guilty by reason of insanity.
Next time, motions in limine and a jury trial. It makes it easier for us to develop a disposition in this case. It's very difficult with a bench trial in a criminal case. Believe me. I did one in my whole career, and it said I'd never do it again. Yeah, I'm sorry to say that.
No, that point is well taken, Judge. And as an appellate counsel, it's difficult to brief something like this, and when you have kind of the fact finder actually ruling on the instructions that they're going to instruct themselves on, certainly. So thank you. That's it. Thank you, Judge. And I apologize for my uber fast talk.
This case will stand submitted, and I want to thank both counsel for the excellent advocacy in the briefs. We appreciate it.
Okay.